Okay, well, welcome back. I am going to talk about blogs, but I want to talk briefly first. I'll keep it quite brief because we have to finish. We have to finish at 25 after 12, which gives us about 37 minutes to do about 2 hours worth of content. Well, I want to talk about, because the title of this talk did promise something about learning objects. And the talk of learning objects these days, the talk of learning objects is, you know, digital objects intended to support learning. Rory McGreal last night, or maybe a couple of days ago, I'm not sure exactly when he wrote it, came out with yet another version of a definition that includes lessons and modules and the linear structured organization. In other words, so totally not that. And so I want to address head-on the idea that knowledge is structured in a way that we can understand, and more importantly, a way that we all share. Because that's the principle behind learning objects, isn't it? That there will be this shared base of knowledge and learning object metadata, that there will be this vocabulary that we all use to talk about learning objects in the same way. And so that if we just get this structure right, everything will work. How many of you will be here this afternoon? Almost all of you. Great. Those, the two of you who didn't raise your hands, change your plans. Because the good talk is this afternoon. Now, while you guys were all having your break, I was working. I was outside taking pictures. Structure and organization of knowledge. This is the sign outside of this very building. If I ever turn this into a book, this sign's going in that book. Now, when I looked at the sign, I had, as a learner, two objectives. One, I wanted to know where I was. And something a little more specific than Cairns. Actually, I'm told I'm not supposed to pronounce the R in Cairns. It's supposed to be Cairns. That's got it? I'm in Cairns. It feels weird to say it like that. I feel like I'm putting on some kind of... I'm in Cairns. Right. See, if I don't pronounce the R, then I actually adopt that Australian sound. Maybe that's the secret to speaking as Australian. It's just like, if there's an R, ignore it. Except for with words that end with the letter A, then add an R. Hence, I come from Canada. I can't understand. Where did the R come from? just glad my name isn't Amanda. It'd be Amandar. Or Armandar, or whatever. Anyhow. Second objective is I need to find a concession shop or a convenience store or something nearby over the lunch hour. So those were my... Okay. Well, you see, I didn't know this, but I figured that was a possibility, in which case I'll actually have to go off campus and dig. But not knowing that, I just wanted to find, okay, did this sign help me? On both counts, no. Okay, where am I? Okay, so Institute Management Business Faculty. That is not where I am, in fact. That's a building nearby. In fact, if you look, there's a little arrow. You are here in the absence of any context. I don't know where here is, right? But if you look at you are here, there are, in fact, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 buildings surrounding where I am. One of those, I assume, probably you, is that building. But am I at a TAFE? Am I at a university? I just got dropped here. I don't know where I am. And this sign didn't tell me. So somebody can tell me, where am I?
We work here. I work here.
Yeah.
North Queensland tape.
A tropical, as opposed to the other North Queensland that isn't tropical? Now, looking for a convenience store, right, I figure, okay, I'll just find the right building. Right, because I don't know what you're going to call it. You got a fairly detailed list. It's Australia. You call these things all kinds of things. You know, I have no idea what anything means. So I'll just find the right building. So, but if I looked, as I looked at this chart, I realized every building has a big letter, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and so on. But if we look at this diagram here, nowhere does it tell me what any of the buildings are. So, what is Building J? I have no idea. If I check this system here and I know exactly what I'm looking for, I might be able to find something which happens to be in Building J. But I don't know what the buildings are. See, it's different perceptions of need. It's the same thing. It's the same campus. Whoever designed this sign is working with the same physical infrastructure I am. And the same language, more or less, and the same educational background, and yet they have come up with a categorization scheme that is completely and utterly useless to me.
They've also got a different need to you.
That's right.
Because their need is not to find the nearest shop. Their need is to show people where the buildings are on
this
campus.
Well, they've shown me where the buildings are, but they haven't told me which building is which. So all I know is where there are some buildings.
In the picture they have.
Yeah, okay, Building G. What's in Building G?
Well, if you look there, you'll find out. You've got to scan the list.
I've got to scan the list. There are 10 different items, right? But normally, when they build a building, there's a purpose for it. Right? Is G a science lab type building? Is it classrooms for business? Or, you know what I mean? Because generally, things like cafeterias and things like that are sort of put together and it'd be like a student services or something. The point that I'm making, though, is that this map didn't help me. And the reason why it didn't help me is not because I am somehow organizationally deficient or a poor learner, or I'm just looking for the wrong things, is that I have different needs and different way of organizing the information from the person who made this sign. Right? Now, the principle of learning object metadata is we will come up with an organizational structure and everyone will use it. And I'm saying, what if I don't know where I am? And what if I don't know where I want to go? My information needs will be different, and the structure will fall down. So the principle of learning object metadata is something that we have to think about really carefully. There will not and cannot be a single system, a single taxonomy, a single hierarchy or organization of knowledge. It is not possible. Yes, you can build one, but if you build one, it will not work. That's my tirade on information organization. Interestingly,
I don't think it aims to be that, though, Steve.
But it is.
It doesn't aim. It doesn't aim to have a single taxonomy. It doesn't. It aims to
provide
containers within which you have a lot of flexibility.
Well, you say that. You say it doesn't aim to have a single taxonomy, and yet it manifestly does. I know they didn't intend to create a single taxonomy, but they did. And this is why I'm making this point. There's a lot of things that get done by accident. And learning object metadata is one of these big accidents that we're about to have. And they don't intend to be imposing a structure, but that's what they're doing. They didn't intend to impose a structure and a way of looking at the world that catered to some needs and not others, but that's what they did. It wasn't intentional. I'm not saying it was intentional, but that's what happened. And actually, this isn't bad. There are two views. We've got the spatial view, and we've got the index view. So it's better than most. I mean, a lot of universities I go to, they just give me the names of all the departments in the building letter, and you're on your own to figure out, you know, well, where on earth could building H be? I have no idea. You just look, wander around looking for the building with the big H on the side and just hope you don't end up in the hospital. Taxonomies. I figure, well, maybe I'll find out where I am. So here's the information I got on the outside of this building. K block, that was actually good because that maps to the map. So I was happy about that. I knew where on the map I was. Even if the arrow saying you are here didn't help me, I knew I could now orient myself because I had the necessary 3 points, right? I had where I am, where one building is, where another building is. I could actually orient myself. That worked. What's in this building? Having a clue. It's Keith's offices. And this is not just this institute. They do this all over the world, right? Again, people assume when they put together naming, signing, and other conventions, they assume that you're in the same frame of reference, the same cultural milieu as you are, the same worldview as you are. But very often, people aren't. And especially in a globalized, internationalized world. Before you had people coming to Cairns, who cared? Right? Everyone knows what Keith Goodwin is. It's what? The chemistry labs or whatever. I'm assuming chemistry labs. I still really don't know. But so, pardon? It's this lecture hall. I'm in Keith's lecture hall. I'm sitting in Keith's chair. So, well, it would have been nice, a little blurby at the bottom there. Just a little thing. Tells me who Keith Goodwin is and why you named the building after him. There may be a plaque somewhere. Put it on the sign. It's just a little thing. Anyhow, but that's the tourist context there. Okay. So I did want to raise that. Oh, good. This appears to be done. No, is this the old or new? That's the new. Go away. Go away. All of you, go away. It's not going to go away. Yes, I do. Whee! It's fascinating how it's so much easier to delete 200 objects than it is to create them. Alright. Anyhow, that's the end of that part of this. You might think I really haven't made a point of significance here, complaining about signs, but the entire field of learning objects today is organized like that sign in the parking lot, and that's, I drew that parallel specifically because if that sign doesn't work, the entire organization of learning objects won't work. It's a very basic level point to make. And to me, it seems like common sense, but somebody did create that sign, and people are creating learning objects. Learning design was included in that interoperability portal site that I linked to yesterday in my newsletter. My newsletter, by the way, is a blog, which I'll talk about shortly. And learning design is like that sign as well. Learning design sort of says, here is a way of presenting learning material, and we're going to present learning material as though it were a play where the students are actors playing certain roles in that play. That's the fundamental metaphor of learning design. If you understand that, you know everything you need to know about learning design. And the idea is that in this play, the students will play out their role. They might make decisions at which point we'll get a branch, but basically they're being directed and things progress logically from one point to the next. And if you look at learning design, it's XML, but basically the XML is an XML representation of your standard linear flowchart. Nothing more, nothing less. And learning design will be able to do about as much as those sorts of flowcharts can do. And it's a way of looking at learning. And when it was originally designed as EML by Rob Koper in the Netherlands, it was intended to be a language that could capture all the different pedagogical styles that there are out there, and it does do that, but the problem is all of these styles are all based on the classroom, person delivering information kind of metaphor, where you move from one point to the next, to the next, to the next. And so everything is in a nice, neat, structured, organized fashion, something that you can represent once and for all time in a single XML file. You can't do this in learning design. It is simply not possible. The language is not structured to allow something like that. If learning design is acting in a play, this is improv. And you can't do improv in learning design.
Steve, just a semantic difference, I guess. You continue to talk about learning design, and I think that most of us, the teachers, we think from the position of instruction design.
Sure.
And it appears to me they're very different things. And that's part of our problem. We're worrying about how to teach things from this perspective of pedagogy, because you made reference to incorporate all the aspects of pedagogy or all models of pedagogy. And we're trying to now talk about it from the perspective of the learner. And I think that your reference to the honeybee site, the groups.
Right.
That was all from the position of the learner. So that was working specifically for all those people who want to share and learn. I think that Alice's point earlier about it is from the position of the instructional designer, so that is saying you've got to do this thing you've got to do in the context of your teaching as instructional.
We
think that that's a hurdle that we're having trouble getting over, is moving from the instructional to the learner.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and because see, that's the problem with this approach, is we keep getting pulled back into the old approach over and over. From the point of view of the instructor, well, it's not supposed to be like there's a method for providing instruction. You know, that's learning design, instructional design. I use the term learning design because that's the name of the IMS specification to which I am referring. That, in turn, is drawn out of the principles of instructional design. And there's, as you know, because you're all in the field, there are various theories and principles, and it's a pretty well-known and understood field. I even had my own theory of instructional design for a little while before I abandoned it, because I thought it was wrong. I don't want to say Grand Central Station, but...
I'm just thinking about your website, calling your homepage the homepage. That to me looks to be a structure that works nice from a perspective of the learning design. Because you've got information over here, down the middle you've got some text to read about, and over here some discussion about it. That works nice for which might translate into instructional design.
Well, you'd think, yeah, it translates into instructional design if you remove the concept of instruction from instructional design. You see, from the point of view, like, if I could get it, and if you could possibly get away with it, the advice that I would give to people who are working as instructors is try to stop instructing. And I would also say something like, forget about, get rid of the classes. Certainly get rid of the schedule, because I think that's especially appropriate here in Cairns. I have to pronounce the R, I'm sorry. But I know in terms of your practical day-to-day reality, you can't get away from it. So the only thing I can do in terms of practical advice is to try to nudge you that way and maybe get you to set up for yourself some sort of information and resource portal, except we shouldn't use the word portal anymore, but resource on the web that will at least begin to start replacing your existing practice. My own experience is once I started working with one of these, well, not one of those, that's a sound thing, but one of thing like my website, that began to push my practice all by itself. And so what I'm saying here is, if you think in terms of a model like this, then you will move towards something that is more like learner-centered design, something that is actually more useful to your learners, both those that are currently enrolled in your class and, more importantly, hundreds or thousands of people around the world who could equally benefit from your own instruction. So it would be like that. And what's the starting point? And now comes the brilliant segue. The starting point is a block. And it has been the starting point for just about everybody who is now advocating this sort of approach to learning and instruction. And I'm by no means alone here in this sort of talk. People like Mark Krensky talks the same talk from a slightly different angle. People like Seymour Papert. I didn't know this until just a few months ago. Of course, he's huge in artificial intelligence, and he's also very important in the use of games in e-learning, and I'll talk a little bit about that, in fact, after lunch. But he was also the person, one of the people behind the laptop initiative in Vermont. No, in Maine. What am I saying? Vermont. Wrong state. In Maine, where the program there was to provide each student in a certain class here with a laptop. I live right next to Maine, and of course I've followed this closely. Huge success, like incredible success. They're renewing it, they're doing it again, there are other states, my own province, New Brunswick, they've been talking about a laptop program. And it's a simple little thing, and Papert is a genius because it is so subversive. Right? You put the learning power into the kid's hands because you gave them a tool. And when the computer was completely in the hands of the instructor and the computer lab and will broadcast this, you didn't see any impact from the computers. But when you put it into their hands, you suddenly removed all the constraints of traditional instructional design. It's great. So there are many other people, James Paul G, Moore, Jay Cross on the corporate learning side, talks this stuff up all the time, so by no means alone here. And they all start with something like a blog, and I started with something like a blog. I started with a blog before there were blogs, so I feel very proud of myself. But if you think about it, it's kind of a natural sort of thing. So, what, you ask, is a blog? Yes, please. Okay, for those of you on the tape, we have solved the strobe problem. And the way we've solved the strobe problem is we brought in another digital projector. We've mounted the digital projector on top of the overhead projector. And then we've propped up the digital projector on the overhead projector with what appear to be plastic bags. And
interoperable plastic bags.
And, oh, I see my internet access on the other one seems to have stopped. And now the way we're switching from one projector to the other is we plug in the other computer and then we actually put
something.
A box or something in front of the lantern. I've spent enough time in technology to know that this is not unusual. This is normal. It's hack it together. There's a whole hacking method. You make the stuff work and you make it do what it wasn't intended to do in the first place. What's a blog? Let's go to a site called blogger.com. Blogger.com was started up 2001, something like that, by a company called Pyra. And relatively recently, it was bought out by another internet company that you may have heard of, Google. So Blogger.com is run by Google. Interesting. and it still smells. Yeah, it does go on. It must be somebody listening to sound files or something in another room.
Maybe if they picked it up from yours, it might have been called a
stog. A stog, yeah. Yeah. Not likely. Stephen's log, stog. I don't know. People complain enough about the word blog. I think stog would have sent them right over the edge. Anyhow, oh, here we go. What Blogger does is it allows you to create an account, and I already have an account, so I'll just sign into it, if I can spell my name right. You'd think that's simple. And then we'll put in my password, my secret symbols, and we'll wait. And, oh, wow. It comes, it goes. So, here's my blog. Well, this isn't my real blog. This is just a test blog that I've created using Blogger. And let's view it first. Yeah. Internet Explorer. I love Internet Explorer. Okay. I've got a window, and I'm hitting a link that opens a new window. Does the new window open up the same size as the old window? No. For some reason, it thinks that I want the new window to be significantly smaller than the old window. Okay. This little blog is not much of a blog, because it's just a test blog, but it has the essential. Basically, a blog is a website that consists of a series of items that are called posts, and the items are displayed in reverse chronological order. Most recent at the top, and then so on, so on, so on, so on. That's what a blog is. There's lots of talk, and you may read in articles and so on and so forth, people talking about blogs as being like personal journals or diaries. And yes, there is a certain amount of a certain number of blogs out there that are like that, but there are blogs on every topic under the sun. You cannot define a blog according to what its content is. The writing style in a blog that has evolved over the years has typically been first person. It's typically been biased, opinionated, a lot like my newsletter, right? of dubious quality. I'm not going to say that about my newsletter. But the idea is the blog is typically presenting a first-person point of view. And the real value of blogging comes from the fact that this is my space. I write what I'm interested in. I use my own voice. I express my own opinions. And it turns out that if you have enough of these, it's as good as journalism. It's better than journalism, because you get the wide range of points of view. Journalism, and I subscribe to a number of online journalism mailing lists. Journalists are really, they're fascinated and repelled and afraid of blogs. It feels like I'm reading Rudolf Otto. And they can't understand how you could get journalism out of blogs. Because the journalists, of course, have the mantra that we're going to present the facts, we're going to present them in a neutral and objective manner. As many people have pointed out, there is no objectivity. And so what we find in journalism isn't something neutral and objective, but more and more, especially with corporate ownership of journalists, of newspapers, a certain conservative, traditional establishment line with a certain arrangement of priorities. You know, all the newspapers have news, they have sports, they have business, but, you know, we don't have a section in the newspaper for, like, trees or anything like that. Although recently they've begun, some of them, to have environment sections. When I'm in Canada and the United States, I say, you know, newspapers never have a section for education. I can't do that here in Australia because you do have the excellent education age section. Although now that they've started registering readers, I can't go look at it anymore. So I'm very disappointed. But they don't do that in Canada. Go ahead.
Can I just ask you, if you created this thing blogger.com, right? Can I go and look at it? Or can you publish it? What do you do with it?
All right. That's... Okay, yeah, so what do we do with this? This is a web page. The address of this web page is downstopblogspot.com. Anybody can go look at it.
It's on the search engine.
It shows up on the search engine.
If you created one, you can put a link to that from your
right.
You could put a link to there, and you could provide a space where students can come in and blog about a particular thing or anything
right.
or whatever it is that you set it
up to do. That's
right. Okay. Right. I mean,
pardon?
Stephen, where would you see the difference between using a discussion group and a blog?
Okay, first I want to get your comment.
Can other people overwrite what you're saying?
Not in a blog, in a wiki. I'm talking about wikis after the break, but no. A blog is yours. You and only you do the content. And this is the difference between a blog and a discussion board. Blogs are owned by the individual blogger. A discussion board is owned by the board owner, the moderator. They can censor your comments. They can remove the post. They can close the board and it disappears. I've had that. Some people who were members of the community called The Well were just pushed all back and forward because their wonderful, lovely community that they built from like the 80s was sold and sold again and merged and twisted, and now it's part of Salon. And they sort of started going like, that's not what we had in mind. That wasn't what The Well was supposed to be. But that's the sort of thing that happens in discussion boards. This, you know, in our context, the discussion board belongs to the college or the university. The blog belongs to the person who owns the blog. Who can create a blog? Anyone. Absolutely and utterly anyone. In my newsletter yesterday, I linked to a discussion of blogs created by pets. Because somebody raised the question, well, what if pets blog? And my response in my newsletter was, well, probably the same thing that happened when pets got web pages. My cat got a web page in 1995 and didn't update the thing for 8 years. So that's probably what pets would do with blogs. But
surely, if you were using this mode of communication, be it blog or wiki or discussion group, for an educational purpose, you would probably want it to be more structured and more...
Why? You're pulling back to that thing and go, why? Why do you want to tell them what to do? Pardon?
You're talking about the example of putting the discussion group in the context of
learning.
Sure. So would you not want them to have that discussion group reflect that context and provide learning experiences that we
want? Well, that's a discussion group.
Can we go out to the anarchy of absolutely everything when we're supposed to be learning trigonometry? There's a reason to have, surely, in a more structured education environment, some parameters around what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yes, a blog has its role in terms of a more general expression. If you were running a course on creative writing, wonderful, great, there. But I'm just wondering at the use of this particular piece of technology in education versus other technology that's available.
Sure. You're thinking as an instructor of using blogs to support learning. Blogs don't work that way. People have tried. James Richardson is somebody who's been working with blogs in education for the last 3 or 4 years. One of the pioneers in the States, and especially the K-12 level for blogs. And he hits that same sort of thing that you're raising. He's talked about this a lot, where we have blogs and the capacities of blogs and the enablements or the empowerments, or today's hip phrase, the affordances of blogs. And on the other hand, we have the educational constraints, where there is a certain set of learning objectives, and the idea is to have something that supports a class. And the two are at cross purposes. You can't say to somebody, here's a space where you can write anything you want to write, on one hand, and at the same hand say, and on the other hand say, but you will write about trigonometry. And to go back to the new students will notice that this is a contradiction. They know this. And you can't pretend to give them freedom. So, it's there's no way around this. Now, in the context of an educational institution where a blogging system is provided, and that does happen, in my article I wrote about the blogging system being provided by the school and at Institut Saint-Joseph in Quebec City, where they actually have set up a blogging system for all the students. And my colleagues, Seb Paquette and Todd Bingham, are working with schools in New Brunswick. And again, they're taking Movable Type, which is a type of blogging software, and they're installing it on the school servers. So, and there are many, many projects like that underway now. And so we have the school providing this blogging environment. But at some point, somebody has to decide whether the blog is something for the student or something for the school, and what that balance, if any, there will be. They installed blogs for all the students in Harvard Law School. And the decision that they went with there, and possibly because it is Harvard, is no restrictions. Anyone can do anything. And mostly, the use of blogs in learning has tended to be more in that direction, because what people are finding that is that the more blogs come to be part of the instructional strategy used by the school, the less the students want to use them. And in fact, there was one instructor that I quote in my article saying, you know, I used the blog in this way. We had regular assignments, and they were supposed to post their answers to the blog. And we were using the blog basically as a writing tool. And at the end of the class, all of the students dropped their blogs like hot potatoes. And none of the benefits of blogging were there, were gained. It might as well have been an instructor's assignment sheet.
So that's where, you know, the way I see it is that there's a whole range of tools and technologies out there. And it's a matter of identifying what does the best job for the purpose intended. And blogs are great for some purposes and probably not so good for others. And if students haven't picked up on it and haven't continued with it, then maybe the original purpose for it was not suited to that technology. So, you know, to me, it's the ability and the skill of the teacher and the person assembling this learning environment to identify what technologies are there, what suits it, what doesn't, what aim they have, what they're trying to achieve with it. So to me, it's a whole mix and match, a whole
range of things. Yeah, and it being 12:25, we're going to have to pick this up after the break. But I'm really disagreeing with you, but I'm really glad you're making these points, because they're the points that need to be made. But this is the fundamental disconnect between the way you're looking at learning and the way I'm looking at learning. And the way you're looking at learning is, it's something we design, we provide, we pick out, and we do this for students. And the form of education that A, I am advocating, and B, I am dead certain is coming down the pipe, is a system whereby it's not any longer the case that we do things for them, it's the case that they do it for themselves. And blogging is the point of this change. Right. Blogging is the point where the student has something that's theirs, where they define what they're going to write about and what they're going to learn about. They tap into their culture, their ideas. And well, it's not a case of you using it at all. Any person can create a blog. You can't stop them. Right? You can help them, But you can't stop them. You can't control this.
It's really about letting go. So, Stephen, are you not suggesting, you know, I've got a little web page that I hook up to one of my courses, and I'm trying to find something fun for them to do.
Right.
If I put a link to a blog and just started, you know, putting stuff in myself,
right,
would that be in the same vein as what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Link it to them, have some fun,
yeah.
Talk about what you're doing.
Well, excuse me. They will each have their own individual blogs. You, a teacher, should have your own blog. And in your own blog, as a teacher, you write about what interests you. Right? And maybe you'll use it to propel instruction, your own personal blog. I use mine explicitly that way. Right, because I've got various messages and various themes that I work, and I try to get that across. But that's not necessarily the case. But what the blog becomes is your way of communicating with other people, maybe your students, maybe the world. But what makes blogging different is they have the same capacity on their end. They get to speak back. And that's the dramatic different thing that blogging brings. It sounds trivial, right? It sounds, and you might say, oh, we've always had, students could always speak out. Well, I went through as a prisoner of the educational system, and I know that this isn't true. And I know that if a student speaks out in a classroom, if they're allowed to speak at all, they have to be very careful about choosing their words. In a blog, a person can create a blog, they can be anonymous. They can talk about anything and everything, and believe me, they do. There are 3-4 million blogs out there now. The vast majority of them have been created by younger people. I've spent hours and hours, days, reading random student, random blogs. That's what I do. I read random blogs. And they talk about everything. And they talk in a way that they would be seriously disciplined in a classroom if they talked about those topics in that way. So it's an equalizer. And that's what the power is. But the power isn't one-sided. It's also, it gives you, the instructor, a power as well. Now, being employed, you know, there is the coercion of the paychecks. You have to be a little more careful than the students do. But nonetheless, it's still that capacity to speak, and to speak in your own voice, and to reflect your own values, and your own culture, and your own beliefs. That's what I've always done in mine. And so it's gotten me into trouble sometimes, but from my perspective, the liberation that my website and my blog have given me have been well worth any of the price that I've had to pay. And that's the shift that's happening in education. And that's the shift of going from teaching to facilitating learning. And I know a lot of people disagree with me. I know a lot of people will never change their minds, and that's cool. I don't have a problem with that. Thomas Kuhn describes paradigm shifts, and he talks about paradigm shifts, and he talks about what he calls the incommensurability between people in the older paradigm and in the newer paradigm. And when people... And it's not people just being stubborn. It's people having a model in their brain, and the very language that they use prevents them from being able to move from where they are to what the new paradigm is. We talk very loosely today about the sun rising and the sun setting. But imagine a person who, when talking about the sun, really thought the sun rose and the sun set, and that the sun moved through the sky. And along comes Copernicus and says, but the earth goes around the sun. And the other person says, well, that may be true, but how does the sun move then in this configuration? Because the sun has to rise and the sun has to set. It's like that. And so... And this is why I sort of go, you know, you're talking about teaching and instruction. It's the language. And if I could push you off that language, then we'd probably be moving forward. But as long as the language is teaching. The language is instruction. The language is design. The language is providing an education. Then we're stuck in this old paradigm and we can't move forward. That's my take on it. I'm sorry? Yes, you can, and you're going to have the last word because we're at 12:32, so I'm not even going to respond, but please comment loudly so I can get it on the tape.
Okay, well, I run a course where I train teachers to teach online, and they are encouraged to use a blog and to write reflectively, and they can write what they like. What's happened is that the reflective learners have taken the opportunity to explore it. One of the teachers in that course had her own year 8 students who are 11 or 12 years old, and she was writing about her frustration with the technology and how she felt, and she gave the address to some of her own students who started to read how she was going with the students, and they changed the relationship between her students and her, and then unbeknownst to her, her own students started keeping their own blogs and then gradually shared them with her.
Sure.
And it became quite an interesting, it is a shift of power and a change in the relationship between them. Just thought I'd say that.
That's an outstanding closing comment. And we'll stop now. We'll pick up after lunch. I really hope it picks up on the tape. But if not, oh well. That's technology. So bye everybody on the tape, and bye everybody here. We're getting back together when?
2:00.
Okay, so from 2 to 2:30. No, I'm just kidding. 2 to 5, I guess it is. Really good stuff coming up. I haven't touched RSS at all. I haven't touched content networks at all. There's what we've talked about so far, there's a whole layer above this that gets into a lot of interesting stuff. So I'll see you at 2:00, and thanks a lot.
Thank you.